This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here as usual with Martin. How are you doing this week, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. Spring is springing. The weather's got better.
It certainly has. And hopefully a better outlook in general. And, you know, hard to believe we're in the third month of the year already.
It's true. Where's this year gone? But then again, the same as last year.
Yeah, exactly. So this week we've got an interesting conversation. We're following the theme of DPU, smart NICs, and similar technology. This week we're joined by Pradeep Sindhu and Jay Menon from Fungible. And I hope I managed to pronounce the name of the company correctly.
Yes,
good to see you guys. Thanks for joining. Would you just like to take a second and just introduce yourselves? Maybe Pradeep, starting with you, and then we can get into the detail of our conversation.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris and Martin, for having us on your podcast. I am Pradeep Sindhu, the Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Fungible.
And I am Jay Menon. I am the Chief Scientist at Fungible.
Great. Wonderful. Now, DPUs, it's a technology we've discussed a number of times over the last few months. Martin and I, we've talked about this in lots of different flavors, haven't we, Martin, in different ways?
We have. They seem to be the flavor of the month at the moment.
Absolutely. So I think what would be good is just for you to perhaps give us an opinion as to why you think what you're going to do in the market is going to be different maybe to everybody else and what problems you're trying to solve, because that's always a great place to start, I think.
And that's an excellent place to start, Chris. Let me say it this way. The term DPU, we invented this term at Fungible to describe a new building block that was needed inside modern data centers. And, you know, we take pains to point out to people that the term SmartNIC is something which is a small subset of the capabilities of Fungible's DPU. And hopefully during this conversation, we will point out exactly why. So to begin with, you know, what was the problem we were trying to solve? It's very simple. If you look at Moore's Law, which has been delivering for the last 35, maybe 40 years, about a decade ago, it started to slow down. And today it's virtually flat. You get a little bit of gains every generation, but the performance improvements aren't great. And so what you then have to do is ask the question, well, look at modern applications. Almost every one of these applications is delivered in a scale-out manner. And if you think of cloud as scale-out applications delivered over the network anytime, anywhere, as a service, that's our definition of cloud. I think it's a pretty accurate one. Then you understand immediately that if you're looking forward rather than looking backwards, the place to focus is scale-out applications, and particularly data-centric scale-out applications. Modern applications like analytics and machine learning are very heavily data-centric. And we're going to be using this term data-centric quite a lot, so I might as well define it. Data-centric applications or data-centric workloads are workloads in which I/O dominates computation. In other words, storing and retrieving data, moving data over the network is actually as important as doing the arithmetic and logic on the data. And we did not have to pay attention to data-centric computations, you know, 20 years ago. But modern applications, the arrival of modern applications combined with the limitations of Moore's Law have forced us to acknowledge the existence of data-centric computations, to pay attention to them, and in fact, to develop an engine, a silicon engine, which is programmable and is designed to execute these data-centric computations, probably an order of magnitude, maybe 20 times more efficiently than CPUs, GPUs, or any other use that exists today. Right. So then the question is, okay, what did we set out to do in the data center? Well, we had a very ambitious agenda. Our agenda was to improve the agility, the security, the performance, and the economics and the reliability of scale-out data centers. We're not focused on legacy enterprise data centers because those things are going to go by the wayside. where you have tons of silos of different equipment. We're focused on scale out, hyperscale, okay. Data centers at the edge. And here, we believe that the opportunity to disaggregate pieces of the infrastructure, particularly storage and compute, but different kinds of compute from each other so that you can make the infrastructure be fungible and adaptable to particular workloads. And to do this in a very agile way is what we are focused on. And to do it at levels of okay. efficiency, which are probably 3 to 4 times what existing data centers can do, including the data centers of hyperscalers.
Okay, brilliant. So you set the scene, and that's great. I just want to sort of highlight something to Martin very quickly. And that's, Martin, the fact that we talked, I think the last time we had a conversation about this type of technology, you made a very interesting point about the idea of there being a difference between data that you store locally for compute and data that you just store. And it sounds similar, a similar approach here. Would you agree?
Yeah, it does. I mean, as we've talked about this quite a lot. I mean, but the idea of having local compute storage, and then you'll have your data storage. But it just falls into this whole tiering continuum, which we've talked about for many, many years. But we're seeing this the concept of data-centric storage, this storage which is very much so much more focused around the data and getting that data in and doing stuff with it and making sure you can transform it and just on the way in. So you make so much better use of your CPU. Yep.
So actually, if I may just expand on that just a little bit, Martin.
Yeah.
The distinction we would like to make is between storage, which is purely I/O, and is accessed via a packet switch network typically, and memory, which is DRAM. There are two very different models here at work. One is a memory model where you do reads and writes of relatively small quantities, all the way down to a byte or maybe 8 bytes. That's a memory model that most programmers are familiar with. But then there's this other model of reading and writing blocks of data, maybe 4 kilobytes, 8 kilobytes, 16 kilobytes. That's storage. And our view is that putting instance storage inside a box, it doesn't make much sense because today you can provide very high performance access to that same instance storage in a manner where it can be pooled by putting it across the network. So we've come up with this notion of hyper disaggregated, which sounds like a buzzword, but it's not.
It certainly does sound like a buzzword, and a lot of people like to come up with their own
yes.
buzzwords.
So,
but
so,
go on, explain exactly what you mean by it.
Hyper disaggregation is really the disaggregation of all important resources over a very high performance network with one goal, which is to make use of these resources much more efficiently than is possible to do if you put them inside server boxes. Any resource that you put inside a server box, you know, can be used by the local compute. It cannot be used efficiently by other servers. That's the issue. And by the way, the name of the company, Fungible, the reason we named it Fungible was to underline the fact that we can promote very high efficiencies inside data center by making the resources in a data center liquid or poolable or fungible.
If I could just jump on one point and underline a point that Pradeep made that was very important. You know, we've had disaggregated storage before. I mean, I think many people in the storage world, we've had Fibre Channel, we've had High SCSI. But the thing that makes what Fungible is doing very important is that we can now give you remote storage at the performance of local storage. So once you can do that, then as Pradeep says, you can now disaggregate and pool and get the benefits of not having stranded storage sitting in individual servers. Furthermore, as you'll see when we get into it, what Fungible lets you do is that storage at your choice, you can create a disk that is compressed, a disk that is encrypted and compressed, you know, a disk that has RAID protection or erasure-coded protection or replicated protection, all of these things, and they just look like local disks to you, and they have the local performance. This is what makes it powerful from all of the things we have got used to in the past, and it's the combination of the DPU with the networking capabilities that are also embedded in the DPU, which we call the True Fabric. It's that combination. That's what makes all of this very powerful.
Just to underline one other thing, which is that The hyper in hyper disaggregated means the ability to disaggregate any resource whose native latency is, let's say, on the order of 10 microseconds or more. So for example, GPUs as a unit, today they're stuck inside a CPU server. We can disaggregate CPUs and GPUs. We can disaggregate FPGAs and CPUs. We can disaggregate even high performance storage whose latency, very, very fast SSDs on the order of 20 microsecond latency, we can disaggregate those. Now, DRAM, which has a latency of 100 nanoseconds or so, is much harder to disaggregate. We're not there yet, but we absolutely have our sights set on even disaggregating DRAM, and with the objective of pooling these resources. So that's the key, and that's different than anybody else does.
Okay. So let's just let's dig down into that a bit deeper then. So I get the disaggregation story; that makes complete sense. And I think, I've been a fan of disaggregated solutions for a while since we started seeing various different technologies come out. Today, your disaggregation is focused around storage in terms of a DPU. So what exactly is your DPU and what does it do?
Our DPU is a new silicon engine, which is fully programmable in a high-level language. That's the first thing to say. It is designed to do two things very well. That's where we started. We started by making sure that the DPU could execute data-centric computations very, very efficiently. In particular, at least an order of magnitude better than any other engine that existed. So let me first give you an example, a few examples of data-centric computations. The network data path, the storage data path, the virtualization data path, and the security data paths are four examples of computations which are at the infrastructure level, which we can call data-centric. In the following sense, all of the work comes in the form of packets on a wire, either on PCIe or on the network. You have many, many, many computations being intermingled at the same time, so you require very rapid multiplexing of resources. Third, the computation is vehemently stateful. It's stateful in the sense that you cannot process packets out of order because each packet changes state, and sometimes that the amount of state that it changes is very large. It may be megabytes when you have many, many, many sessions. And the third property of data centricity is that if I take the ratio of bits per second to joules per second, to be very precise, that is the ratio of I/O to computation, it's medium to high. So when you have those four properties, we call that data centric. And what I can tell you, Chris and Martin, is that no one has looked at this problem from grounds up in a fundamental way. So what the DPU does, we set it out to solve those two problems. One, run data-centric computations, at least in order of magnitude more efficiently than CPUs particularly. And we have achieved that. We are about 20 times more efficient on a performance per watt metric or performance per dollar metric. Number two, DPUs enable servers, once they're embedded inside a server, they enable servers to interact with each other over a standard IP Ethernet network much more efficiently than is possible today. Well, how much more? A factor of three. In other words, we can run a network at 90%+ utilization without a single packet drop. Try doing that on a standard IP Ethernet network. It doesn't work. In fact, if you go back at the history of networking and you look at the various technologies like fiber channel, InfiniBand, they had attempted to solve this congestion problem in the network in a way which was fundamentally not correct. That is, it was never going to work at scale.
Okay. Before we get down into that level of detail, I just want to just come back on a couple of points there. So first of all, I hear what you say about the idea of being able to run all of these different tasks at the same time and therefore get more workload through. One of the things that seems to be an issue as far as I've seen is that if you imagine where we're headed with NVMe, you could potentially have hundreds of streams coming from a single device or in and out of a single server, and that multiplexing of all of those parallel streams could be incredibly complicated to manage if every one of them is being encrypted differently, is being managed differently from various different aspects. So I'm guessing when you say that your efficiency comes along, you're talking about that efficiency to handle very many streams occurring at the same time.
So Chris, you're exactly right. You touched on the core of the issue, which is that the workloads that we're calling data-centric, they're very heavily multiplexed. In other words, there are many, many concurrent computations which are independent of each other that need to share this engine that we call the DPU. And so the ability to context switch very rapidly is critical. And I'll give you one number which will be astonishing to designers of computers. We're able to do a thread switch every 120 nanoseconds and still deliver an IPC, which is instructions per clock, of 1.5. If you try to do this on a general purpose CPU, whether it's ARM or x86, you will be fortunate if you've got an IPC more than 0.01, okay? So that's okay. The difference. In addition, we do one other thing in the DPU, which is very important. Most of these so-called smart NICs have general purpose CPUs, typically ARM, and then which are not optimized for thread switching, and then a bunch of accelerators. And you can see these two things at two extreme ends. The accelerators are inflexible, and the general purpose CPUs are very general. So there are two ends of one spectrum. And the space between these two ends of the spectrum is completely unoccupied. Well, in the case of fungible, our architecture couples general purpose, heavily multiplexed CPUs very tightly with accelerators. And that's the magic of the DPU. That's what enables us to give all these benefits, very high performance on data-centric tasks, combined with the ability to program it in a high-level language.
Okay. So, Martin, just to bring you back in on this, you know, this is an evolution to me from what we see of numbers of cores, CPUs in a machine, highly parallel workloads, you know, virtualization now leading on to containerization, bit by bit pushing that envelope of trying to do as much on a server as possible and as many parallel threads on the server, but actually wanting to be able to do that in a way that your data is somewhere else. It's just yet again pushing that problem, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's treating your whole data center potentially as a virtual host. And as you start getting into these things and you start being able to program your data center, we think of the beauty of way back when, we've both got mainframe backgrounds, but let's bring it a bit further forward to when VMware first started shipping and people started getting excited and they realized they could carve their single server into different workloads and they could configure it. They could have a workload which had 1 gig of RAM or one had a single core, and but they can. With this, and this whole idea of the disaggregation and the programmability means that we can do that for data center. We can actually take the whole thing and we can say, well, and you can start building this into the concept of GitOps and things like that, where you hold your whole data center design within a repository, and you could switch it if you wanted. You could say, actually, well, today I'm going to switch it and I'm going to actually have everything moved around to these GPUs, going to talk to those servers. That's what I need today. The concept of a programmable data center, the software defined data center, which is something which we've been talked about for years, and actually we all look at it and think, you know, well, that's not very real. It's very hard to do, because you can't say, I want to move a terabyte of memory there. I want it attached to that server today, and then I want to split that into 1,000 machines tomorrow and have that talking. You can't do it. It's not there. It's not fully software defined. These tools, the DPUs, things, I'm really seeing as the enablers for us to get there. Now, the interesting thing is how people are going to manage it, and also how many people really need it. Obviously, your mom and pop shop down the road probably don't need it, but the larger corporates, enterprises, and the hyperscalers, yeah, they certainly do need it. Almost the ability to switch your data center. Let's go back, Chris, to the 70s and the 80s, where batch workloads, if you could actually reconfigure your data center for a batch workload, and it was easy to do, you could configure it in such a way, and you could potentially switch overnight. There's going to be lots of practicalities around that, but it's really exciting from a programmability point of view.
Yeah, and I think there are some scenarios similar to what you said there, Martin. I mean, remember mainframe days, it's easy to go back and talk about mainframe because that's, you know, what we've done for such a long time in our early career. But, you know, you look at the way that things like batch and online was configured differently during the day and at night for performance group usage, and how you actually biased the workload so that, you know, you've biased online transaction processing during the day, but you biased the batch stuff at night. You changed the way that performance groups worked across the entire machine to make that happen. So, you know, it's something that we could do on a big machine when the whole machine was the machine that we ran everything on. But now we want to do it where we've got components. And this is, I guess, the step we're headed. So, guys, you know, looking at this, what's your current products that you've got in the market? What do they do and how do people consume them?
You know, maybe before going to our products, I just want to say a few words about this concept of software-defined data center.
Yeah, absolutely.
Martin, you know, the term that you used is exactly the right term. People have had this idea that I can disaggregate resources and combine them flexibly for a long time. The problem is that you could not do it efficiently. All of the hyperscalers disaggregate storage and compute. But guess what? Their storage is not disaggregated efficiently. And so this remains kind of a theoretical concept. In fact, if you look at an enterprise, you will see 5 or 6 different silos of equipment, a VMware silo, machine learning silo, an analytics silo, a database silo, SAP or Oracle. And that same siloing is now coming to hyperscalers, which is actually pretty sad when you think about it, because they're having to specialize in a fixed way their infrastructure, and they build it in pods rather than individual servers. But that inefficiency is now coming to hyperscalers. What we are saying is that our ability to disaggregate efficiently means that instead of having 60, 70 different physical server types, I can have maybe 6 server types. These are Lego blocks that I can then, using software, actually build a data center dynamically in less than 2 minutes, tailored to a specific workload and indistinguishable in performance from a bare metal data center that I built by hand for that application. That's the magic that the DPU is going to unleash. So now on to the particular products that we have. We have a very high performance storage product, which is scale out and very, very secure. And I'll let Jay touch on that in a bit. The second product that we have is, so that's on the storage side. Then on the compute side, which is either CPUs or GPUs, we have a smaller DPU that comes on a PCI Express card, and then you can plug in and actually enable the server, standard server, or a machine learning server to be connected into the fabric that we referred to. Now that fabric, by the way, is enabled by the DPU, but it uses completely standard switching. So there's nothing, you don't have to change your network. The existing network can be improved by a factor of 3. So before I turn it over to Jay, the one other thing I want to point out is because the DPU is able to do computation next to data, it's very important to understand that you do want to compute next to data in instances that you can. So the DPU can perfectly well do computation like filtering, like joins, all of the SQL primitives right up against the SSDs or hard drives. And this gives it an enormous advantage in efficiency compared to reading the data over the network. Of course, you want servers to interact over the network. That also we do very efficiently. But what I want to point out is that we are also able to manipulate the data right up against where it is stored. So Jay, please go ahead.
Yeah, so the product that we have, we call the Fungible Storage Cluster. It's a scale-out storage cluster. Today we support block protocols. Over time, we'll, you know, the plans for doing beyond block to file object and other things, as you might imagine. But today it's a block storage protocol. It supports NVMe over fabric, specifically NVMe over TCP today. And it has 4 things that make it, in my opinion, very unique. First is the performance is unmatched. You take one of these boxes, it's a 2U, with 24 SSDs inside of it, and it can deliver, depending on the kind of volume that you want to provide to the customer, all the way up to 15 million IOPS. The two of you have been in storage a long time. You know, we didn't used to talk millions of IOPS. We used to talk 300,000, 100,000, 500,000. Those were good performance numbers, right? Now we're talking millions, and now we're talking 15 million IOPS.
So that must be the new standard, Jay, is it? That, you know, the new hero number, it was a million originally.
Yeah,
the new hero number was 10 million, and now the current one is 15 million. Somebody's going to have to come out with 20 million.
This is the new hero number, exactly.
Chris, we see our way clear to doing about 20 million, which is the limit of what SSEs can do.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, sorry, Jay, one thing I would just say there is I would be happy to understand how much you're leaving on the table and how much you're not leaving on the table in terms of the capability of those devices. So if you're running at 99% of what they're capable of, then whether it's 15 million or 20 million, I wouldn't be that bothered. I'd be more interested in you running those devices as efficiently as possible.
Perfect. Perfect. Really good segue. You know, we defined this metric about 6 months ago. We call it the performance efficiency metric, or PEP. And it's precisely what you're saying, Chris. Just, you know, formalize that definition of what you just said in words, which is take, for example, our box has 24 SSDs. Let's say each of them is capable of 700,000 IOPS. Take 24 times 700,000. You can't possibly do more than that. That's about 16 million or so. And we're doing about 15 out of 16. So that's the PEP metric, which is how close to one can you get? We're about as close to one as you can get as anybody that I know of. Yeah. And I've been in the storage industry a long time too, including IBM. So that's one area in which it's very unique. The second area in which I think it's very unique is how flexible it is. So on this thing, you know, you can create NVMe namespaces, you can call them volumes. In the old days in iSCSI, we called them LUNs. And each one of those things can be separately tuned to say, I want compression or not, I want encryption or not, I want it replicated, I want 8+2 erasure coding, I want 4+2, all of that, you know, and I want a certain level of quality of service. All of that is specified on a per volume basis. The power of that, as you know, in today's data centers, people buy many different kinds of storage, what Pradeep was calling silos, because, hey, this storage is good for Oracle. I'm going to buy this thing from NetApp. I'm going to buy this other thing from Pure. I'm going to buy this other thing from EMC for this other workload. And before you know it, you got all these different kinds of boxes. Our goal, because of this incredible level of flexibility, right? Because most people will just say, look, I'll give you RAID 6 and that's it. I don't care what your data is. Everybody gets RAID 6. That's not what we do. If you want RAID 6, we'll give it to you. If you want 8+2, we'll give that to you. If you want something else. So that level of flexibility and encryption, by the way, every volume gets its own key, a separate key. So when you have multiple customers, those can all be kept apart from each other. So that level of flexibility means that you can put different kinds of data inside this box because you can mix and match not very high performance data, not very reliable things that you don't need a high level of reliability and so forth, all mixed together. So that's the second thing that I think makes it very powerful. And the third thing is, you know, the way we provide reliability is very matched to the scale-out model that's important to us. You know, in the storage world, people have gotten used to high levels of, you know, making the individual box reliable and saying that's good enough. But in a scale-out world, you got hundreds of racks. Racks can go down. You've got to be able to protect yourself when a rack goes down. And what we do is we provide this erasure-coded protection across our boxes. So if you want true 8+2, you can buy 10 of our boxes, put them in 10 different racks. You can have two entire racks go down, and I'm still protected. The way most other people do this, probably everybody else does this, is if you want rack level protection, they'll let you replicate the data or triplicate the data, but nobody does erasure coding the way we do. And the only way we can do that is because of the DPU and the true fabric capability that Pradeep talked about earlier. Otherwise, this stuff won't work. It won't be very efficient to be able to do this across the network and do all this, you know, parity computation and all this stuff.
Let's just put that in context for a second. So what does it look like to the end user? It looks like a 2U shelf, 24 drives. It's NVMe over fabrics, but how is it connecting to the host? Does it need another DPU device in the host, or can it use a standard NIC? What is it going to do to get into the, to get that volume exposed into the host?
So one of the really fantastic things that happened in the storage industry is the arrival of NVMe, the NVMe standard, and in particular NVMe over fabric. So what we did was we leveraged the NVMe standard to completely virtualize storage. And the key abstraction that Jay mentioned is the abstraction of a volume. Now, what happens is that if you have a DPU inside your client, we can make the drives, which happen to be remote. It doesn't matter where the drives are sitting. They could be sitting, the volume, the contents of the volume could be, well, actually would be normally sharded across many, many, many SSDs sitting in different machines in different racks. But what the software of the DPU does is it makes all this distributed stuff appear to be a local volume. That's the key. So to the application running on the host, it sees this as a local drive. In fact, you know, we have performance measurements where we can show significantly better performance with remote drives running on an FS1600 compared to plugging those same drives into the x86 locally. Better performance.
Okay, let me just explain what I was meaning by that, Pradeep. Sorry. The reason I was asking that question is because I can see two potential scenarios in terms of the way the model could work, okay? You could have your storage appliance, of which you're exposing NVMe over fabrics devices to a client server, which has got an NVMe over fabrics driver, and it talks directly to that device in some form. Now, if you did that, there's very much a single pipe that goes from that server to the shelf or the shelf of disks. If you've got a DPE or some other device sitting in the client, then potentially the client is managing the process of taking data from those 10 different boxes all in different racks. And maybe it's the thing that actually aggregates it up at the client level rather than letting the array do that work. And in which case you've got a different model, because if one of those boxes dies, the recalculation of that parity, you've got a question, who's going to do that? Who's going to recover that data? Is the client directing it? Is the client waiting for that to happen? So trying to understand just exactly where that relationship sits between client device and array is, I think, quite important.
Yeah, so let me just address, so there are two cases here. There's one case in which the server just has standard NICs and does not have a DPU. And then the second case is in which the client does have these one of these cards that Pradeep talked about that has the DPU. So in the first case, you just have a standard NVMe over TCP driver, and that just comes with Linux. I don't have to install anything on the customer side. And the IOs flow to one of our boxes in the cluster. And then after that, we take care of all the communication between our boxes to compute RAID and erasure coding and all of that other stuff. And that's the data path. Now, I also want to tell you a little bit about the control path.
Jay, before you go to the control path, this thing that Jay described is on a per volume basis. So if the host, the client that we're talking about, has 100 volumes that are exposed, each of these volumes would go to a different FS1600 machine, potentially.
Yeah.
Okay, and all of the distribution, the location, all of the processing would be done by the master, and the data would be sharded across a bunch of slaves.
Correct. And, you know, the nice thing is the host actually doesn't need to know. Unlike scale-up boxes that you get in enterprises, you sort of have to know onto which box your volume went. In our case, you just come and read the volume, write the volume, and we take care of it. We place it. It's all easy to manage because it's removed from the administrator's role.
Plus, you know, very importantly, it's virtualized with no loss of performance. In fact, it's virtualized with performance enhancement, which is a really strange concept because normally when you virtualize things, you lose performance. Well, here we've been able to virtualize storage and give you better performance.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the first model. What was the second one?
So in the second model, if you put the card that has a DPU on the host side, then the primary thing you get is offloading of a lot of work, that IO work that was done in the cores on the client side server. Those get offloaded onto the card. And so you just save up maybe 50% of the CPUs on the x86 server, now available to run whatever applications you wanted to run. And then secondly, you also get the encryption can now be end-to-end, because I do have the DPU on the host side. Now I can do the encryption end-to-end. I can do compression end-to-end. And I get the benefits of this true fabric network, which has extremely low tail latencies. Without this DPU on the host side, you're still running TCP, and TCP has, you know, there are tail latency issues that are well known. We're not trying to get around that if you don't have our card on the host side. But if you do, then you get around that, so you get even better latency. So it's all of those kind of benefits that you get in the second model. Now, in both cases, there is a control plane for how you create these volumes. And we have an API that we expose, but we also make it, again, easy for the customer. So if the customer is running Kubernetes or containerized, we have a Kubernetes plugin, a CSI plugin, that they would use to provision, create snapshots, create volumes, delete volumes, and all of that stuff. So we make this very, very easy on the customer.
Okay. Martin, does this sound like SAN 2.0, like a better SAN?
I suppose it does, really. SAN's not gone away. We keep telling people that local storage was a bad idea, and now you're proving it for us by making remote storage look like local storage. But that's what we like. Storage admin comes back, sort of.
Are you talking about sequential access method from the IBM days?
Oh, dear. that's taking some.
Don't get us talking about Visa. We'd be here all night. But I think, you know, I don't mean to just make that as a flippant comment. I think it's quite a relevant comment, because if you look at the way that the market has changed and has gone from one side to the other, we went very much from the idea of everything disaggregated, everything in separate servers, to SAN in the 2000s, to people then starting to say that hyperconverged was a better model because we could distribute the storage and the compute in separate nodes again, until we hit the limits of scalability in that model because of the speed of things like NVMe devices. And now, what a surprise, we come back around the loop again, and we can see significant benefit from a form of centralization which disaggregates the physical storage back out of the server, but at the same time leaves us some degree of management controllability in those servers, because we've actually got the local DPU, which is giving us that ability to do both the control plane and the data plane, which is a different... We didn't have the control plane to that degree in the previous model, I don't think, Martin. And that this is possibly, you know... It's we're just going back around the loop again, aren't we?
Well, we are a bit, but it just feels like it takes out the weirdness and the variability we get with vSAN when we start putting vSAN in. Just makes me feel that this can kill vSAN stone dead. And I know I've got lots of VMware listeners, but I don't think we'd miss it.
No, I don't think so. And I think the key bit, probably more relevant, is if you look at the way that people are building their infrastructures, if you genuinely wanted to say, well, I've got a VMware environment that runs on 24 nodes, you know, at one particular point in the day, and then you take it down and you run it off 16 or you run it off 8, and then you use the other servers back into some sort of analytics work at night, you can reconfigure that within minutes, and the storage doesn't change and is persistent and kept somewhere. So when you reinstate that later the next morning, it genuinely could be executed as a model of working. Whereas we've talked about as a theoretical model previously, this is the sort of technology that could make it a lot more real, I think.
Chris and Martin, one thing I wanted to mention was that the amount of time it would take for us to configure in software a data center which is specifically tuned to a particular application, it's under 2 minutes. So as long as the computation you're doing lasts significantly longer than 2 minutes, you can multiplex your data centers at that rate.
Yeah. So, you know, you could take things down for an hour, do something, come back. And even if you were looking at demand, I mean, it might be a bit excessive to do demand scaling of VMware nodes in a cluster, but it's not necessarily. It is potentially practical. So, you know, it's an interesting sort of problem that we're solving rather than just previously where it was about centralizing the storage.
You know, there's one other thing I do want to say, which is that we, I think, are the first company that has separated the control plane and the data plane of storage from the beginning. And the reason for doing this is that the data path cannot be executed efficiently on a general purpose CPU, while the control plane, there is no better engine than a general purpose x86 or general purpose ARM to do it. So that's one piece. The second piece is that previous technologies like fiber channel, they separated the network into a physically separate one. There was a compute network and there was a storage network. And if there's one lesson I learned, you know, through my days at Juniper, separate networks are bad. That a unified network, if you can have it, is the best possible case because you want servers to interact with each other. You don't want to separate storage servers into their own little ghetto and GPU servers into their own ghetto and so on. You need one network. But the difficulty that's been there is that standard IP Ethernet networks did not have the capability to provide the features that you needed, particularly congestion control. That's the problem that we have solved at very large scale. And that is an industry advance that was badly needed.
That's an interesting one, Martin, isn't it? Because we would probably have advocated that we would be very happy to keep the network separate, but that it was only done for a good reason, because we knew we could control our own traffic better than having it on a shared network.
Come on, Chris, we were at the stage where we used to split our own storage traffic. We'd have you'd have a fiber channel SAN yes. for your for your disk and channel SAN for your tape. So.
Well, for replication as well, in one instance in my scenario.
Oh, yeah, we'd have multiple SANs just to split traffic away. And the idea of being able to put all these things over one. Even today, Chris, I still have arguments with storage admins about mixing tape traffic and traditional storage traffic. We still have these arguments. So I still think we can get away with it most of the time. We find the odd case, but it doesn't happen very often. And it's like the ongoing arguments we have with DBAs about storage and how many volumes they need to spread their... Oracle database across, because the manual still seems to suggest that you're running entire everything local disks and weird and wonderful triplexes and things like that. So, hey, this may allow us to fix some of that as well, or we just let them think they've got it anyway.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So this technology sounds great. Who's using it today, and what examples of customers have you got that are taking good use of this?
Several hyperscalers that are looking very closely at the technology. We have run proofs of concept at second-tier companies with enterprise companies, and we are just moving from these POCs to trials and then full deployment. One area that we've seen a lot of interest is in high-performance computing, and this is an area where people want a lot of performance. Another set of areas that we've seen a lot of pull is where people want to disaggregate GPUs, CPUs, and high-performance storage. So those are the three building blocks. And for analytics and machine learning, I am certain that the infrastructure will go in this direction, in the direction of scale-out. So those are some of the examples. And Jay, you might want to touch on specific customers that you've worked with very, very closely, without giving actual names.
I think that in addition to, obviously Pradeep mentioned hyperscalers, the tier two cloud providers, online retailers, very large online retailers, I would say telcos who are working with telcos, the science community in general. I think that in addition to the NVMe over fabric storage, we have so much computational capability so close to the storage. They have these big science problems that takes them 6 months to solve. And they're looking at, what can I do instead of bringing all this data into my x86 servers and then munging that data? If only, because we have the capability so close to the storage to be able to do operations on the data as it's flying by in real time at, terabits a second. Every one of our box is about a terabit a second, right? 800 gigabits per second. So being able to do that kind of processing, there's a lot of interest we're finding in the general, national science community in the US and in fact in Europe as well. where they love the ability that maybe they can take a problem that takes 6 months and shrink it down to 6 weeks or 6 days. This kind of thing is possible. So I think that's the other area.
Let me touch on one other area where we can deliver outsized performance advantage. If you take a look at the SQL primitives, particularly database joins, when you have large distributed databases that you need to join, not just two databases, but two tables, you have multiple table join. When you try to do that over a network, things are really, really slow. We have computed that we can speed that process up by close to two orders of magnitude. That's not a small delta. And so one of the things that we plan on doing over time is to implement directly on the DPU the primitives for SQL and make them available to the community.
So is this proof of concept work, or is this a product that, or feature that you have available? Is that still proof of concept work?
So this is a concept. It's not a feature that is available for consumption now, but we have done enough work to know that this can be implemented with the kind of numbers that I just said.
By the way, even without that next generation feature that Pradeep was talking about, we do have customers actually running MySQL and Cassandra, and they're getting performance that is superior to the normal way those things work, which is having local SSDs on the servers. So already we have excellent performance, and it will only get better with the kinds of things that Pradeep is talking about.
So Martin, I think that idea of offloading not just the block protocol, but other protocols, again, something we talked about in the NVMe protocol just in a previous discussion, that idea of genuinely being able to say that I can actually have a data protocol and not a storage protocol is potentially really tantalizing as an opportunity to do some very interesting things.
It is. And this is probably a discussion for a different time is, okay, so what does that data protocol really look like? How do we end up with standard data protocols? We don't want a mishmash of standards all over again, because the storage industries are renowned for it. And everybody likes to extend and or embrace and extend if we go back to the old Microsoft way of doing things. So yeah, but there is some tantalizing glimpses of what could happen. I'm on a rich protocol. I don't want it down to the lowest common denominator. But yeah, I think we could see some exciting things in it. And we keep saying, Chris, that storage is boring, but data isn't.
No, everybody we talk to is moving more towards data than storage, to be honest, because even if it is a storage platform, even if it is initially a storage solution, everybody now is focused on the fact that it's actually really the data that's the valuable piece and not the moving the blocks back and forth type thing. Mm. So it's a very different scenario than it used to be. Okay, so just if people would like to follow up, Pradeep, where can we point them to? Your website, other information?
You can certainly point people to our website. And in fact, on the subject of providing Fungible's full capabilities, the DPU's full capabilities to data centers, we have some very exciting news coming up.
Okay.
So please stay tuned for that.
Fantastic.
This is in less than a month from now. And so if people watch our website, you will be able to see some spectacular news coming
up. And is that just fungible.com?
That is fungible.com.
Perfect. Well, I think this is really interesting as an area. It's really developing, I think, very, very quickly. So, you know, we definitely need to get you to come back and talk a bit more about some of those aspects that we didn't really have time to cover today. But, you know, sorry, to cover today. But, you know, for now, thanks for joining us. And it's been a great conversation, and definitely look forward to the second time round.
Chris and Martin, thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss our technology.
Yes, thanks for the great conversation. Thank you, Chris and Martin.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.